Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's online at bcfmradio.com. This week, former Special Branch and Army officer Charles Shoebridge talks about the Manchester terror attack. Also, Eddie Clark from Bristol's Palestine Museum on the recent general election. And Grassy Knoll shooter James Files, more this week from the JFK Chicago Mafia Assassin. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. If you want to join in, I'll have details at the end of the show.
My name's Charles Shoebridge. I'm a former counterterrorism intelligence officer and also a former army officer where I specialised in counterterrorism operations.
We've just had the terrorist attacks in Manchester. One of the most troubling aspects of it is it looks as if, rather like the 7/7 London bombings, that the security services had several warnings about people, had been following the individual bomber. And it almost seems as if we haven't really learned anything from 7/7. Something like five warnings altogether from the Islamic community in Manchester, from the mother of the bomber, and also from the FBI. So the reason that the security services give is simply that they've got about 4,000 staff, but they've got 3,000 terror suspects they've got to be constantly watching, and they can't watch them all. What do you make of all this?
Well, first of all, what we've got is a rerun, as you suggest, of events that have happened in the past. At least it appears to be the case at the current time. We would, of course, have to wait. Normally, we would say we have to await the outcome of the inquiry, and indeed, two inquiries have already been announced into MI5's handling of the information that they did have, and we know they did have some information about this man. But the problem is that when it comes to inquiries about how MI5 have performed, almost invariably, those inquiries are going to be carried out, led and reported on by MI5 themselves, and that's what Amber Rudd, the Home Secretary, has announced in this case. In due course, there may be, I suspect there will be, an inquiry by the Intelligence and Security Committee in Parliament, but that will take some time, and of course there also will be inquests into the dead and the lawyers for the victims' families will be able to answer some or ask some questions, and it's in those processes rather than the MI5's inquiries into themselves that in the past we've actually learned an awful lot more. And so, for example, with 7/7 in July 2005, when the 52 people were killed plus the four bombers, and you'll remember that just 2 weeks after that there was another attempt, again a very serious attempt to commit very similar atrocity, and again these people, it emerges, were known to MI5. Now, at the time of 7/7, government ministers, and of course they're always speaking on behalf of MI5, which is on the record, and then off the record you have any number of Fleet Street journalists who, of course, are speaking as a result of off-record briefings by the security service. They stated in some cases, but generally implied, that the security service had no knowledge of these people. It was only really over the next 2 years that we found out that that was totally untrue, and that, in fact, as you suggest, they had a very great deal of information, particularly about the leader of the 7/7 attacks. And since then, it's emerged that in almost every single case where a serious terrorist attack has either taken place or has been attempted in the United Kingdom, and this is really since 9/11, it's emerged subsequently that MI5 actually had knowledge of, and in some cases quite detailed knowledge of, those suspects. And of course the other consistent theme we've got here is that in every single case when they knew about these people, they then made a decision, an active decision, not to actually follow or watch those people, or at least if they were watching them, not to do anything about stopping them, perhaps having information and not passing it on. So the problem comes with the argument that that's because they haven't got enough resources. I would say this is it's twofold at least. The first point is that whilst it's superficially attractive to say, well, there's 3,000 people, there's 4,000 people perhaps who are of interest, and therefore we can't expect the security service to be watching everybody all of the time. That's really similar to saying, well, there's 5 million people in Britain who've got criminal records and we can't expect the police to be watching them all the time. Good intelligence work is not about whatsoever just watching everybody that might be a suspect. The whole point of good intelligence work is to gather and then develop and work on producing usable intelligence, which you can then use to make an informed decision about where your resources should be applied and deployed. The fact is that the security service, MI5 we're talking about in particular here, has had its resources and its powers massively increased over the last 12 years since 7/7 happened. And yet again and again we've got this situation, not that they haven't got enough resources, although that's the argument that they use all the time, but that those resources aren't being used effectively. So if we look back to Monday evening last week, and in the weeks before that time, in fact, all the way back to the Westminster attacker, and this argument applies to him too, that at the times before those attacks took place, there was no greater priority for the very substantial resources of MI5 than those particular people. So it's not a question of having resources, it's a question of the decision-making process by which MI5, for whatever reason, decides that people are not a threat. And the fact that they get it wrong so regularly, I think, as your question suggests, ought to be ringing alarm bells. But instead of politicians and the media asking questions about why is it that MI5 seems to consistently make these decisions not to watch people who then turn out to be actually very dangerous figures, not peripheral figures as they're described by the media, but actually very central figures. Why is it that this decision-making process is apparently going wrong? And that may ring further alarm bells that actually in some cases that the reason why they're not being watched by MI5 might be because there is some other kind of relationship between those people in some cases and MI5 itself. Let's not forget, it is MI5's function to go out and recruit informants. So if people are working as informants for MI5, that has to be a good thing. That is their purpose. But of course, if that means then, and I say it's a big if, but if it's the case that then them working as informants for MI5 and providing some perhaps low-level information then gives them a degree of protection from the police and others, that of course has to be a bad thing if the result is what we've seen in Manchester.
Yeah, it's all very difficult to predict. Yeah, very difficult to predict this sort of thing. But what about the potential that Salman Abadi may have had a relationship with, say, MI6, the Foreign Intelligence Service, or even the intelligence service of an ally, say, for example, the German BND or the Israeli Mossad or something like that. I mean, one of our allies, if MI5 are told, well, hang on a minute, or the police are told, this is an agent working for somebody else, then they may not be able to engage with that person potentially.
That is an issue, isn't it? But it's particularly the case, of course, when it's through our own domestic or foreign intelligence service. But the police, if it was a foreign intelligence service, then it, although they may not, of course, be informing British intelligence services, and you can understand why, because they want to keep their sources and assets for themselves, it would be then difficult to then apply pressure on, for example, the British intelligence services or the British police to not take action against somebody without actually notifying them that they are a person therefore of interest to the Foreign Intelligence Service. But yes, certainly the same things that I've said about UK intelligence services perhaps looking after protecting assets in terms of their informants, if they believe those informants are valuable, may apply. And this is only conjecture after all, but hopefully it's informed conjecture and speculation that this may be the case. For example, we saw after 7/7, the leader of the 7/7 plot that killed so many people, he was known in such detail by MI5. He'd been subject to so many different operations, and yet they sought to distance themselves from him in the months and years after the 7/7 bomb attacks took place. And I speculated at the time, which was considered quite controversial then, that one possible reason, and I don't say any more than that, one possible reason for him not having had action taken against him or apparently not being watched or monitored more closely than he was could be that he was a trusted informant. There could be other reasons as well, such as gross incompetence in the decision-making process. So going back to the question we raised earlier about resources, if MI5 say that they are watching some 3,000 people, you'll note that every time they fail to stop an attack, and again, nobody's saying that's an easy job to do, but that is their task. Every time that they fail to stop an attack, the number of the people that they're looking at, according to the media, goes up massively. For example, it was 2,000 suspects before the Westminster attack. After that, suddenly the newspapers were saying they have to watch 3,000 people. And then after the attack in Manchester, it wasn't long before the Times and others were carrying briefings from the security service saying that actually the number is something like 23,000 that they have an interest in. And so it's difficult to judge these figures because they're just coming straight from the security service. But as I say, there was no greater priority for those resources, and they are quite substantial resources, than the people they were actually, the people who carried out these attacks.
Amazing.
So that may suggest that they are actually putting those resources into watching the wrong people.
Yeah. I was quite surprised at the speed with which the Manchester police announced that it was a suicide bombing 2 hours after the actual attack, because of course there's always the potential it might simply be a concealed nail bomb that's been an IED or whatever that's been exploded by remote control. Do you think that's realistic to know within 2 hours for certain?
I think in this case it probably was. And the reason I said that, I mean, for example, I was on some TV stations actually predicting that the police very quickly would have an identity. The reason I say that is because in this case, there's an awful lot of CCTV video coverage of that entire area. I mean, it's an area that's absolutely saturated, I imagine, with CCTV. And so since you can actually see the point of explosion, you can then track back that person. And this person was a person known to police. He was known to the security services. And, I mean, there have been some reports that documentation was found at the scene. I don't know whether that's true or not. That hasn't been confirmed. But nonetheless, you've got a situation where, with good quality CCTV and that person being known, plus, of course, people reporting in that their loved ones are missing, and, of course, maybe his relatives reported in. Also, for all we know, again, we don't know the details, and it may have fully emerged. For example, he may have used a smart card, for example, for travelling on the metro system or whatever, the public transport buses. All of that may have identified him. For example, it may be that he used a credit card at some point or left fingerprints or something like this. I would suspect it's more of an electronic situation. And maybe, of course, also perhaps his phone may have given him away somewhere as well. So I think in this day and age, in a situation like that where you've got very good quality CCTV coverage, and then you can track that person back to a point where perhaps they touched a card reader, or perhaps their phone was in touch with a series of different base stations that would then identify him, it could be any number of reasons. But I think in this particular case, it's not surprising that they had an identity so quickly.
Okay.
But there could be other reasons.
It took a little while for the identity, but it was the speed with which they said it's a suicide bombing that surprised me. Anyway, getting back to the warnings, when we had the attack on Lee Rigby a couple of years ago, we had the attackers, Michael Adebowaje and Adebowaje, I think his name was. Both of these were people who'd been actually brought to Britain by MI6 deliberately from Kenya. So our security services, again, are very, very strong hand in this, because the Kenyan authorities, when they were brought back to Britain, said, look, these guys are maniacs. Are you sure you want them to come back? And then, of course, they killed the soldier.
Yeah, exactly. And what was reported at the time, and I don't think anybody really denied this in any strong way, was that it was, as you suggest, it was pressure from the UK security services that had him released in the first place. And again, this comes back to the subject that I've talked about earlier, that, again, you have to wonder the degree to which these people are considered, at least by the security services, as assets. It may be or may not be, but that would be consistent with the actions that we've seen again and again. Another case is where people are not prosecuted, where cases get dropped in court and so on. And again, you have to wonder why that's happening unless they're being protected. And the reason that they're being protected could be because, if indeed that's what's happening, could be because the security service perhaps naively believes that these people are actually giving them good quality information and don't present a threat to the UK. Or alternatively, it could be that they have made a decision, especially if we're talking about MI6, that actually there are more important things than saving British people's lives through terrorist acts. For example, one could easily see an argument, it's not one that I subscribe to, you won't be surprised to hear, but there will be people who would subscribe to an argument that if every 10 years a couple of dozen of people in Britain are killed, yes, that's horrific and so on, but how does that compare to Britain's interests being furthered by, for example, using these people, these jihadist extremists that have been, shall we say, at the very least had a blind eye turned to their activities in furthering British interests abroad in destabilizing areas such as Libya, Syria, parts of Iraq, helping our allies such as Israel, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and destabilizing governments such as those of Gaddafi and Assad. And of course, we can see the reaction or the outcome of those in terms of terrorism blowback. Don't forget the word blowback means it's got an element of self-infliction about it, self-creation. So, and also, of course, in terms of the very large refugee flows we've had from those unstable areas. And so there's no doubt whatsoever in my mind, and indeed, you know yourself that I've, for example, commented on this for many years on Twitter and elsewhere, that there is a policy, and it can only be a policy, that because it's happened so consistently, that of British jihadists, particularly of Islamist extremists, being used by the intelligence services to further British government geopolitical and geostrategic objectives. And that has particularly been the case, as we've seen in Libya and Syria, quite successfully destabilizing countries, linking British policy to the interests, not necessarily of British people in terms of those who are then going to be targeted by terrorism, but linking British policy to the interests of our important allies such as Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Israel. Between the three of those, of course, you know as well as I do, the very strong financial grip that they have over this country, and particularly over successive governments.
You raise the point that a lot of these questions simply haven't been asked by the London press on our TV screens, on the radio and in the newspapers. How close are MI5 to the media? Because they don't actually even have an official press office.
They like to suggest, of course, that they don't have a press office, and they're right, I suspect, in that. But then, of course, someone like me would say, well, you don't really need one when just about every mainstream home affairs or security correspondent acts as a press officer for you. You'll find it's very rare that you'll find criticism of MI5 in the media. In fact, it's quite interesting for me to see over the last weekend where you had, for a very rare occasion, where MI6 is being criticised by Peter Oban, a very distinguished journalist that I've got a lot of time for. But throughout the whole article, there's another narrative running, which is that how excellent MI5 are, and that MI6 have somehow dropped MI5 into trouble by facilitating jihadists aboard. There are two problems with that argument. The first is that up till at least 2013, and I've tracked this quite in some detail, up to at least 2013, MI5 was complicit in the movement of jihadists to places such as Libya, Syria. And we can know that because you've got a situation where, even though it's been unlawful in the United Kingdom since 2006 to take part in terrorist activities or fighting activities overseas, until around 2013, despite the fact that in 2011, 2012, and 2013, you had many British people going overseas to Libya and Syria to fight against Gaddafi and Assad, nothing was done to stop those people from going there. And the legislation was there, if it's, and indeed is now, used to stop people. And the reason for that, in my mind, and I said so at the time, and it seems to have been borne out, was that because those people going to places like Libya and Syria were actually on the same side as British government policy. They were going there to fight against Assad and Gaddafi, to destabilize those countries. And as we know, the destabilization of Syria is absolutely key to the geostrategic plans of countries such as Saudi Arabia and Israel in particular, because, of course, Syria is an ally of Iran, which is the enemy of those two countries I've just mentioned. And so you can see how it fits into the geostrategic plans. And that's why I'm always keen to say, well, when I'm actually pointing out that MI6 has facilitated, without any doubt in my mind, the movement of jihadists, for example, from the UK to Libya and then from Libya to Syria, just as happened in the past, for example, with Afghanistan in the Soviet years, with Bosnia, with Chechnya, the movement of British jihadists to these places to fight. They think they're fighting jihad, but actually they're fighting as well for what is perceived by the British establishment to be British geostrategic interest. And so people think I'm criticizing MI6 when I say that. I'm not. And in a way, it's a backhanded compliment. It's singing their praises that they are an extremely effective body in orchestrating the destabilization and in some cases even the downfall of what British government policy says are enemy regimes or enemy governments. And so actually what they're doing is government policy. And that's why, again, I take issue with the Peter Oburn analysis that we saw recently, much though I admire so much of his writing. I take issue with him because the second aspect of what he said, not only did he say that MI5 are doing a great job, actually we know that up to 2013, they were facilitating jihadists going to places like Libya and Syria, not just because of the statistical analysis that I've alluded to in terms of nobody being stopped going there until about 2013, which of course is actually when ISIS turned on the West, but also a recent article in Middle East Eye where actually jihadists were interviewed themselves, people from Manchester, who said that MI5 was facilitating it. So now we know from pretty much all sides that it's true. But also, you can look at MI5 culpability in this way as well. The fact that I mentioned earlier, that every single case where a terrorist attack has taken place and they were known to MI5, they made an active decision not to stop that, not to stop that person, not to watch that person. And that is either design, or most people, I suspect, would think it's incompetence. But again, that suggests they're not doing a great job. Whereas for MI6, of course, their purpose is to carry out foreign policy objectives, and it's what they're doing is entirely in line with British government policy. And therefore, the second issue on which I take issue, if you like, with Peter Oburn's analysis, is the idea that there's somehow some kind of few bad apples in MI6, some, if you like, rogue officers that are not carrying out MI6 or government policy. On the contrary, all of this is entirely consistent with what British government policy has been, which is to absolutely destabilize as far as possible Libya and Syria to assist the opposition in those areas, with the results that we've seen, one of which is terrorism. Another, of course, is the wave of refugees that have flooded into Europe, with all the impact on politics, the rise of the far right, and many other aspects that, of course, we can consider another time.
Okay, finally, the issue of accountability, which you're sort of raising there. You know, it's all sorts of questions about MI5 and how accountable those civil servants are there, and intelligence officers. 7/7 bombings in 2005, there was no public inquiry. We had inquests where the families of the victims of 7/7 were very unhappy because they, in many cases, were simply not allowed to put questions at those inquests. And now we've got a situation with the main body that's supposed to oversee the security services, the Intelligence and Security Committee, is not sitting because there are no MPs. We're in a general election month. So how is it possible to actually call people to account? For example, if there is an officer that said that Salman Abedi should not be put under surveillance, will they have their collar felt in any way?
I think the answer on past record is no. And the issue of accountability, of course, is key to this. So effectively, there is no accountability for the security services, MI6, MI5, or GCHQ. We've seen that again and again, where even decisions relating to the amount of, or the release of information to bolster government claims, allowing us to go to war, for example, in respect of Iraq. The whole load of claims that were made, particularly by MI6, regarding weapons of mass destruction, had a catastrophic effect on bolstering Blair's rationale for taking Britain to war. And because they were exploited by the media, even turned public opinion to have a short-lived support for that war. So these are very, very serious issues, not just in terms of deaths of many hundreds, if you include British soldiers, of British people, but also, of course, hundreds of thousands, if not more, people overseas that have suffered as a result of these catastrophic failures. But of course, in terms of MI6 and so on, in terms of what we're saying, of course, they may not even be seen as failures because they've achieved the greater aim. But in terms of MI5's stated role, which is to protect the UK from terrorism, these clearly are failures. But again and again, we've seen situations where GCHQ, for example, MI5, have admitted in the past that some of their officers have made mistakes or have, for example, accessed information, personal information, in the case of GCHQ, which they weren't allowed to. But in every case, there have been no prosecutions of officers. There have been no sackings, as far as we know. All that we hear about are people who are whistleblowers against MI5 or GCHQ or MI6 who then go to prison, whereas the people who actually are making these errors don't seem to suffer as a consequence. In respect of oversight here, we've got the Intelligence and Security Committee is the only supposedly independent body, along with the Surveillance Commissioner and so on. But these people never, it's extremely rare that they make any findings against the security services. It's almost unheard of. The response usually to MI5 failings in this way is to reward failure by increasing their budget, because the argument is made, and it's being made every day now in our newspapers, that the reason for this is because MI5 doesn't have enough money. Apparently they need enough to be able to keep everybody under surveillance all the time. That seems to be the logical outcome of the rationale they're putting forward. And as I mentioned, that isn't the basis of intelligence work. Intelligence work should be about your decision making, where you actually apply the very substantial resources they've already got. Think about the ISC, the Intelligence Security Committee. Its reports go to the Prime Minister first. It doesn't report to Parliament in the same way that other committees do. Its members are appointed by the Prime Minister rather than elected by MPs. And so it's a very limited form of oversight. And if you remember when we had the spectacle of about 3 or 4 years ago of the heads of MI5, MI6 and GCHQ being grilled, as the newspapers called it, live on TV for about an hour by the Intelligence Security Committee. And it then emerged, as I predicted actually at the time, live on Twitter, that actually they had been given all the questions beforehand in advance, agreed those questions, and had, of course, had chance to prepare and rehearse their answers. And it appeared to me rehearsed at the time. And so you've got a situation that is extremely limited oversight. And all we can hope for in terms of accountability and actually even documentation being produced and information being released is through other processes such as the inquest process and also the perhaps leaks from it, foreign intelligence services and so on. But again, increasingly there's movements towards more secrecy in courts when it comes to these kinds of issues. Mm. And so I'm afraid that when it comes to accountability, the direction of travel is probably to being even less accountable than the intelligence services are now. But until that accountability is there, we can expect these kinds of failings, if indeed there were failings. And again, we can't know for sure there were failings or that it was inevitable unless there's an open and accountable process.
No, I mean, what would you say needs to change? I mean, we need, I think, a little bit of insight into what you think might actually make a difference to call to account people who it looks as if time and again have been making serious mistakes that have led to British people being killed as a result.
Until we know the basis upon which those decisions were made, it's very difficult to say in what way they could be improved. All we know is that they have to be improved, because actually, if you take away, I've made this point before as well, that if you actually consider only the terrorist plots which we know existed, I mean, every couple of weeks we see headlines saying MI5 thwarts terror plot, but there's usually, and I say it's usually, very little, if any, evidence that a terror plot ever existed. It may have done, but we just don't know, because they are constantly saying terror plots thwarted. And also, we notice that when a terror attack actually takes place, suddenly the media are saying, oh, MI5 only thwarted 30 terror plots in the last 5 weeks. Nobody mentioned those at the time, but again, without any evidence. But what I would say is that of the terror plots thwarted that we know there's and some evidence. In other words, somebody's been arrested, and again, very large number are acquitted or released without charge, even after these arrests. But if we take even terror plots thwarted where there are arrests, where there's explosives found or substances found and so on, even if we take just those into account, actually quite a high proportion of the total number of terror plots, MI5 fails to actually stop those happening. It's probably close to 50% or 30 to 50%, something like this. It wasn't until quite recently the majority, if you think of all the terror attacks that went through and all of the terror plots that actually they've thwarted, such as the airlines plot a few years ago. Really, I think it needs a change of culture, that actually the MI5 needs to move from a situation where it amasses information to where it actually works more closely with the police to actually taking action as a result of this information. The problem is that when you take action as a result of information, you often betray your source, and therefore the information would dry up. But at the end of the day, what is the point of having information such as that a terrorist is about to carry out an attack or may carry out an attack unless you act on it? And that's in that context that these reports, particularly they're not verified reports, but if they turn out to be true from the FBI, that the FBI did actually pass that information with specific information, and quite recently, only in 2017 was that information passed to MI5, that would have been a catastrophic failure of intelligence. And again, it needs an independent body to get to the root of why these mistakes are happening and expose the truth, if indeed it's true that these people were being protected by MI5. And the reason that that has to be exposed is to stop it happening again, because it's one thing to protect your sources, but it's another thing to fail at your key task of protecting British lives, particularly British civilians' lives, at a concert. We don't know if that's what's happened, but of course, until there's a greater accountability, we won't know. And there's no reason from a security aspect why that kind of decision-making process, why those mistakes can't be publicly discussed. But at the moment, that's very unlikely to happen.
And that was former Special Branch and Army officer Charles Shoebridge talking about the Manchester terror attacks.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
I'm joined by Eddie Clark now from the Palestine Museum. Is that still called the Palestine
Museum?
It
is, yeah.
On Broad Street. Tell us what's the purpose of Palestine Museum?
Well, the Palestine Museum really is to kind of show people that the truth of the situation for the Palestinians. So it's basically there as an information centre. It's non-political. It's funded by the volunteers.
Well, hang on. It's bound to be very political, surely.
Well, not really, because since when has fighting injustice been a political thing? It's a human rights thing. I wouldn't call it
political. I mean, people would say, wouldn't they, that there is a war going on of some sort between the Palestinians and the Israelis, and you've got to be impartial.
Well, not really a war. What I would say is there's one well-armed group that are attacking an unarmed group, basically. I don't see any war there.
So knives, not arms?
Not really, no.
Yes, they are, actually.
No, afraid not.
I mean, this is one of the problems, isn't it, there's been in places like Jerusalem and Tel Aviv, is the attacks by Palestinians with knives.
We're talking about some incidents, mainly at checkpoints. There has been some incidents in Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, but against the backdrop of the amount of Palestinians that are murdered by the soldiers, I think it's not that great.
So, I mean, it's bound to be politically charged, which is why I think, you know, it's difficult for you to say it's non-political. I mean, do you have to do that for your funding or something?
No, we have no funding. We do that simply to illustrate that we're about facts. If the facts become political, then so be it. But facts are facts. In 2014, 2,500 were crucified by, you know, superior firepower in Gaza. That is a fact, and that's the sort of facts that we put in our museum.
So what about the whole background to it? Do you not support the Israelis' right to be there?
We're completely neutral. I don't have a view on that. Our main kind of function is to make sure that Palestinians, you know, do get justice, because at the moment there's 2 million in Gaza, which is a concentration camp. There's another couple of million in the West Bank, which has 500 checkpoints. Under these circumstances, I think it's really not about whether Israel has a right to exist, but the Palestinians do have a right to exist.
Well, look, we're speaking just almost exactly 50 years after the Six-Day War in what would 67? Have been 1967, yeah. June 1967. Which lasted for 6 days at the beginning half of June in that year. Now, this led to the abandonment, really, of the original borders of Israel, and it also led to the Israelis kicking out the Jordanians, Egyptians and Syrians from East Jerusalem.
That's correct. I mean, what can one say? I mean, it's a continuing occupation. It's really about expanding the territory of Israel at the expense of the indigenous population. That is against international law.
The Israelis would say that it was an untenable area of land they were given, which was lots of little bits of land in what was then Palestine, and they had to obviously sort of join them all up.
Well, I mean, that would be their narrative, but the narrative for the Palestinians is that they didn't invite anybody to come and invade their country. So really, it's a non-starter, really.
Well, anyway, look, one of the big reasons for all this is Britain, because it was the British mandate in Palestine in the Second World War and before the Second World War that has led to this situation. The British had a bit of a fight with the Israeli terrorists, what were called at the time Jewish terrorists, the Stern Gang, people like this. And then they eventually said, OK, well, let's let them have their own state. So it was the British that were very intimately involved in the creation of Israel.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Balfour Agreement, basically was a way of actually giving something that didn't belong to them to a party, just basically for the war effort. You know, they were beleaguered against the Turks. They wanted America in on the war. So really, the Balfour Agreement wasn't about helping Jewish people. It was a convenient, operation. To get support for their campaign against the Turks.
I mean, it strikes me a bit like the Crusades, really. I mean, from hundreds of years ago, you know, they had these Crusaders going over there, knights in armour, to try and take Jerusalem. We've now got Europeans marching across, taking territory, white Europeans who aren't from that part of the world, a little bit like a kind of modern Crusade. But look, how's this latest general election affected, you know, the British general election, if at all? Has it affected Britain's policy towards Palestine and Israel?
Well, I mean, one of the first things that Theresa May said, that she would honour and celebrate the Balfour Agreement. And of course, the Balfour Agreement is the one particular document that, you know, Britain should be really, really, you know, not proud of. You know, it was the instigator or the setting up of the Zionist state in Palestine.
Now, when was the actual Balfour Agreement?
That was 1917.
Yeah, because at the time it was quite secret, wasn't it? People didn't even know that it had been signed. A bit like the Sykes-Picot Agreement, which was after the First World War, which is where the various countries like Syria and Saudi Arabia were created and the new lands divided. That only became public after the Russian Revolution. And the Russian revolutionary said, hey, everyone, look at this agreement. No one knew about this.
Yeah, absolutely. And the Palestinians didn't even know about it. So there you go. So there it is. Third party.
You have to laugh, I'm afraid, even though it's horrific for the people that live there. But, you know, because at the end of the day, Britain's policy towards the Middle East, effectively, it seems to be mainly to do with supporting the Israeli state and the Saudi Arabian state, which you would think as a Jewish and a Muslim state might be opposed, but they don't seem to be.
Well, I think really most of the Emirates are kind of basically puppets, aren't they? I mean, in Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, you wouldn't call them, you know, democracies by any stretch of imagination. The rest of them, I mean, I think they're just powerless against, you know, the might of Israel and its allies.
What about Qatar?
I don't know much about Qatar.
Well, that's where Al Jazeera comes from.
Well, I like Al Jazeera. But, yeah, I mean, you tell me. What do you think about?
Well, Qatar has been singled out over the last 10 days or so as a country which the other Gulf states are now although they would not admit it, they're blockading. They've blocked flights. They've cut off all diplomatic relations with Qatar. And I wonder if that might have something to do with Al Jazeera. If you remember back in January, Al Jazeera did a sting operation against
Israeli
political attaché.
Yeah, yeah.
And that Israeli political attaché said that he had £1 million slush fund to spend on infiltrating the Labour Party and getting rid of any pro-Palestinians in the Labour Party. Yeah. So anyway, back to the general election. What's the Labour Party's attitude to that part of the world at the moment? Even though they didn't win the general election, they're still quite influential.
It's interesting to find out exactly, you know, what's happening, because I think you've got two stages of the Tory party. You've got this the behind the scenes one that makes these deals, and then you've got the one that pretends it's for the working man. You know what I mean? And it'll say, well, we put the rate up to £9 an hour. We care about the working man, and then it drops in fox hunting. Well, I don't know many, you know, working men that are interested in fox hunting. So you have to really look at them as having two faces, the face for the public and the face where they do the deals.
So why did Theresa May call this general election? She's ended up really short shooting herself in the foot and ending up with totally losing a majority and now having to rely on the Democratic Unionists and the Orange Order. The effectively loyalists, yeah. Extremists from Ireland in order to keep her government in office.
Yeah, well, I mean, UDI is a paramilitary group, you know, not far removed from, you know.
Well, was. I mean, they have, since the Good Friday Agreement, they're not anymore, but they're certainly on loyalist leanings rather than just mere unionists.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely.
So why how have we ended up like this?
Well, I mean, if you consider the Brexit, that's an interesting thing. I mean, the average Tory did not want, you know, Brexit situation. UKIP came along.
No, the Tories were for Brexit. The majority of Tories were definitely for Brexit.
Ah, okay. I'd argue that one. I'm talking about the...
Not necessarily the majority...
I'm talking about the voter, not the party, you know.
Yeah.
So realising that UKIP could steal their thunder, they stole UKIP's thunder, and that's why UKIP was so successful.
Isn't UKIP a sort of party within a party within the Tory party?
Well, I'd call it the extreme of the Tory party. Or it's a gopher between the National Front or the BNP.
But they've been
Tory
wiped
party.
Out in this general election.
Well, they have, because people realise now that that's all they were good for. They're basically a racist group.
That's a big accusation, because they've actually, where there is any evidence of racism, they have been very quick to exclude members from the party, kick people out, because obviously that's something that they need to be quite concerned about if they're going to retain their credibility. And so that, I mean, they will have people from the BNP trying to join UKIP, for example.
No,
and then as soon as that was identified, those people are immediately kicked out of the party. People like Ken Livingstone suspended or whatever from Labour, there's a great big sensitivity over these things.
But I mean, a bit of sanitation, dust it all down. But basically, people voted UKIP because they, you know, for one, I think it was a cry of help more than anything else. They were, you know, they were losing out under a Tory government, and I think Brexit was just a slap in the face.
They didn't vote UKIP.
Well, no, they initially voted UKIP. And
well, they voted for Brexit.
They got up to 14%.
I mean, the main reason is immigration, isn't it? And that it doesn't look like that's going to be stopping anytime soon.
No. Why would it? Why would it? And I don't think the racists that voted UKIP or Tories or wanted Brexit were actually aiming for the Europeans.
It's a very simplistic way of looking at it, that people that want to limit immigration have to be racist. That's really simplistic.
Yeah, no, I think it would be wrong to do that. I think there's genuine concerns, and quite right. But I think a lot of the racism is not towards European, but it's towards black.
But I mean, racism is rife, though, of course, in Israel.
100%.
It's actually an apartheid state. Yeah, so is there any prospect of progress, do you think, towards stopping the apartheid over there?
I think there is. I think what we're getting now is with social media, the media can't actually bend people's ears anymore. I think, you know, I think this latest vote proved that, where what you've got the youngsters, immune from the BBC stuff, finding out their own information and voting accordingly. So I think, Israel will go the same way. I think the Israelis are fed up with being, you know, regarded as monsters. So I think the change will come through the social media, through young people.
It's interesting, isn't it? I mean, you and I can remember the 70s, 1970s, 1980s, the kind of golden age of television, where there was some brilliant drama on, great comedy, actually reasonably impartial news compared to today. I wonder whether the internet is a bit the same, where we're just at sort of towards the end of the halcyon days of the internet.
Yeah, but I mean, who needs comedy when we've got the Tory party? I mean, you know, is there any funnier... You couldn't write up the script, would you, for this?
Well, when Theresa May went to see the Queen to ask her if it was okay to form a government, and the Queen said yes, you do wonder whether her husband, Philip May, right. was actually wearing the trousers in that conversation, whether Theresa was even allowed in the room.
I would doubt it. poor Theresa. I mean, I shouldn't feel sorry for her. She's been such a traitor to the, you know, working class. And pretend to be now the party of the working class. I mean, you know, really a bit of a joke.
What about the monarchy as well? We've heard that it's exactly 100 years since the royal family changed their name from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha to Windsor. I mean, just seem a little bit... I mean, for propaganda purposes, during the First World War, ITV News covered this, and the propaganda reason was that the Goethe bombers were dropping bombs on London and killing school kids, etc.
Right.
Meanwhile, the royal family's name was Goethe, and of course they were the Saxe-Coburg-Gotha family.
Yeah, yeah.
So what do you think, what do you make of the modern... We've also had this in the Daily Mail, in the Mail on Sunday... More revelations and the transcript of these tapes from Princess Diana talking about how dreadfully boring Balmoral was and how she just had to get away from the place. It had this really bad atmosphere everywhere. And also about her problems with bulimia really starting when she realised that Charles didn't love her, that he was actually in love with Camilla. Where is the royal family heading?
Well, I mean, you know, really, it's always been heading towards the abyss. She's a dear old lady. I mean, she's 90 years service. I mean, it's not bad. But really, what she does, she amplifies, you know, wealth and difference. And I think really, it's not tolerable in a modern.
I mean, she even got the public to pay for the repairs to Buckingham Palace. I remember
300 million. Yeah. I mean, the point is, it's antiquated, and it's time for a republic, I think. But you know, she does good work, you know, for the tourists.
Anyway, look, Eddie, we're going to say goodbye in a second, but just remind us whereabouts is the Palestinian Museum.
Okay.
When are you open?
We're open Saturday and Sunday, 11 o'clock to 6 o'clock, and it's 27 Broad Street, and that's BS12HG.
Eddie Clark, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
It's been a pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
James Files is the Grassy Knoll shooter. More this week on his account of the JFK Chicago Mafia assassination.
I pray every night, every day. I don't run around with my Bible. I don't run around trying to tell you all about the Word of God. That's not my job. You want to hear about it, I'll be more than happy to sit down and talk to you about it. But I don't try to push it on anybody. We have a lot of different kinds of religions here.
Why, briefly tell me why you're in prison right now.
I'm in prison for a specific reason. When I come out of the federal prison, I did a federal stretch and I was out for a little while. People started trying to kill me. When they started trying to kill me the first time, I was at along Quentin Road and Rollins Road in Round Lake Beach, shortly past midnight, driving a little Chevy Chevette. And the cops had been harassing me there. They knew who I was. Every time they see me, they'd handcuff me, get me out of the car, and my papers blow out, they'd throw all my stuff down the street. But this particular night, I pull up the stoplight there. I'm on Quentin Road, fixing to make a right-hand turn on Rollins Road. I'm staying with my aunt and uncle at this time. They're about two blocks down from there. I looked up in the rearview mirror, and I seen a car pulling up behind me with no lights in the next lane. And I thought, shit, it's cops again. You know, I'm going to get hassled again. It's not a squad car number, but I just figured it's detectives, you know. As it pulls up alongside of me, I'm looking in the mirror sitting by the door, the little door mirror on the side, and I see an SMG come up. What anybody don't know that is, that's a small machine gun, automatic weapon. As I see it coming out of the window, I roll across the seat, hit the door, hit the ground, roll back up against the rocker panel of the car. They put 30 holes in my car, full clip they put into it. As they were pulling away, I come up off the ground with my piece, and I got up about four rounds. I'm on federal parole at that point. I'm not supposed to be carrying a weapon, but you never find me without a weapon. I got off four rounds, took the back window out. They kept going. I jumped back in my car, took a right on the Rollins Road, went down to Grove Avenue, pulled into the house of my aunt and uncle's at 1620 Grove. Went in there and got the tarp from my uncle out of the garage and put it over the car so they couldn't see the bullet holes. That was the first attempt on my life. I got out of federal prison in 88. This year's late 89, early 90, I guess. When they started trying to kill me on the street, that was the first attempt on my life in the free world, as I call it. Next day, I went to see somebody down in the city, and I went up and I asked him a specific question, if we had a problem. I said, I went and I did my federal time. I said, I got busted on the chop shops. I didn't take nobody down with me. I said, I went, kept my mouth shut. I didn't testify. I didn't give nobody up. I took the conviction. I done my time. What's the problem? We got a problem. Let me know. And he told me, he said, Jimmy, he says, he always called me Jimmy. He said, Jimmy boy, he says, come down, come down. He said, listen to me. He said, you got no problem with us. He said, you did your thing. He said, hey, you didn't have the problem when you was down. You got money, looked after certain people for you, took care of your family. You had no problems. When you come out, you went to the restaurant. He said, everybody parked, everybody come by to see you. He said, we dropped a lot of envelopes. He said, you have money when you come out. Everybody looked after you when you come out. That's respect. He said, don't think we're after you. He said, whatever you've done, it's with your previous employers, not us. That's on the other side of the fence, the people that you worked for before. He said, them, not us, Jimmy. He said, I give you my word on that. The second attempt, I was on my motorcycle, and it's a long story. I won't go through all that.
Hold a minute.
That was the agency. That was the government. Somebody in the government.
Government has tried to take you out.
That's what I honestly believe. After I talked to certain parties in Chicago down in the city about them trying to kill me, and he's telling me that was my previous employers, what we're talking about here, we're talking about a government agency. I won't say which agency it was that tried to take me out, but I know at that time I had people in the DOD on me because I had taken certain material off the computer at Oxford from the arsenal so that I worked in the office. I had an excess classified material there for building new tanks, new helicopters, everything. I had the gun emplacements off one of the Black Hawk helicopters. I had the allocations for everything. I had the rate of firing, anything that's classified, because we made a lot of the stuff there. We made the nitrogen cable to fire the Sidewinder missile inside a federal prison. Okay. Anyway, the second attempt was, well, now I realize this here is not the crime family after me. It's got to be a government agency. The second attempt on my life was, late at night, they ran me over on my motorcycle. They hit me so hard. They bent the frame on it. They totaled the motorcycle out. That's all on record. Next time I come around, the third time, with these two off-duty officers. One of them is David Ostertag. They will never admit they had a contract on my life, and I want to say one thing. I got no hard feelings against either one of these officers, even though they tried to kill me. I don't take this anything personal. I take it they were doing a job. They were doing what they was paid to do. They just blew it. But the thing is this. I'm here because somebody opened up on my partner and me. They tried to kill us in broad daylight on May 7th, 1991, 3:15 p.m., maybe 3:30, in the middle of Route 12 in a little place called Buffalo Grove. We're between Quentin Road and Long Grove Road on Route 12. They forced us off the road. When they forced us off the road, they say it was a high-speed chase. It really wasn't a high-speed chase. They spotted me at a gas station. I didn't even see them. I paid for the gas, got in the car. My partner, David Morley, he was driving. As we pulled out from there, they got in behind us. They got up alongside of us. He started hit the gas to go. And I told him, no, hold it. Pull it over. We don't run from nobody. And my exact words were, fuck them. We don't run. Pull it over. We'll deal with it. But they cut us off. Like, he pulled into like a part of a driveway. It was gravel, a little fast. He hit the brakes. We slid into a little tree. The tree we hit wasn't any bigger than my arm. I threw the door open on the right-hand side to exit the car. This was the leased car. As I threw the door open to exit, they drove their car, which is a white unmarked car, into the side of our car. When I seen the front of the car coming at the door, I jerked my leg back up off the ground so I wouldn't get it cut off and they were broken, and dug my head, and when they hit the door hit me and knocked me back into the car. I bounced off the dash, and at that point, they opened fire. My partner, David Morley, very good man. He saved my life on several occasions in the free world. His left hand is paralyzed. He'd been shot up a couple times before in shootouts. He can't use his left hand. At this point, he's leaning down, fumbling under the seat of the car, looking for his gun, looking for a 9mm. And I'm yelling, get out, get out, get out. And to me, it seemed like it's taking forever. When he got the 9, he put it up under his arm. He's got to close his arm, reach across, open the door to exit. Well, this is only a few seconds, but it seemed like a lifetime to me. We come out of the car. When he come out, he took the first shot. David Ostertag went down. At this point, when I come out, there was no need for me to even shoot. The other officer, Bittner, I didn't know they were cops at that time, neither did my partner. We had no idea they were police officers. He crawled up under the car, and he was saying, they're going to kill us both, they're going to kill us both. A day after Tag was already down.
That's all for this week. Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails and download the podcast the week before our broadcast at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, former Special Branch and Army officer Charles Shoebridge, Eddie Clark from Bristol's Palestine Museum, and James Files, Chicago Mafia hitman. Also to studio engineer Dave Pazenko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon, and anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokescroft, just off Jamaica Street, 0117 909 6897. The website is prsc.org.uk. Also, you can go to the National Volunteering website, do-it.org, and find opportunities here there. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
So don't you leave on the smoke. Lead us to a mountain.